Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar, the podcast where two sadly no longer unemployed chefs discuss restaurants, food, cooking, restaurant culture, and funny stuff that happened to us when we were in our 20s and didn't know any better. Or, in fact, did know far better, but did it anyway because we didn't care. Isn't that right, Dave Dog?
That's way more accurate, yes. Inhibitions are limited.
So I have a funny story, and that's actually not the funny story that I cleared with Nate 2 seconds ago because I thought of a better one. So I'm going to tell a funny story about the single best restaurant nickname I've ever been given.
All right, take it away.
Restaurants are very...
Brother Jay?
Restaurant nicknames are very... restaurants are very nickname-intensive places. At Tristan, you could say, who was on the line? And the answer was Shorty, Chachi, Teen Wolf, Spider, and Sarah. And the only reason that Sarah didn't have a nickname is because she picked up on the fact that everyone else had one and wanted one so desperately. So it was funnier to not give her one. Remember the day I told her nickname was Sarah and she just glared at me for like an hour?
That was a real hot button issue with her. And the more she prodded, the more we're just like, no, you don't get one.
I actually gave her a nickname on my last day. I started calling her Swamp Fox. Because she's from Louisiana and she's cute. Yeah. So I was like, there you go. So she's in my phone as Swamp Fox, and I call her that from time to time now. But for the longest time, she didn't get a nickname. Well, I've had a couple.
That was way funnier, stonewalling her.
I've had a couple of nicknames in my day. And some of them have been funny and some of them have been pretty lame. I mean, my name's Jesse, so I got called Jesticle a lot. Jester every once in a while, but Jester isn't cruel enough to really stick, you know?
Jesticle. Like,
Jesticle, on the other hand. Jesticle, on the other hand, had some staying power. I was called Spano for a while after Jesse Spano from Saved by the Bell.
Why?
Not any good reason. Just dumb stoner cooks giving each other dumb stoner nicknames. The cruelest nickname I ever had was Jesse Big Butt, which is what they called me at Commander's Palace. Now, I can take a fat joke all day long, but the lack of imagination really hurts. Like, that's the best you could do, Jesse Big Butt. Like, you couldn't come up with anything better than that. I give as good as I get, but I deserve better than Jesse Big Butt. But
yeah, that's pretty lame, dude.
But the best nickname I've ever been given had to do with a diner that I used to work at. And it was actually the diner where I met my wife. This is, I don't know, 20,000 years ago. So we were small children, but she was a smaller child than I was. And that plays into the story. I was like 21 and she was like 17. And it's interesting when you find yourself 21 years old dating a 17-year-old. I took my dilemma to my dirtiest, grossest friend, my most Christian Republican friend, and my mom. And I was like, I'm 21, I'm dating a 17-year-old, what do I do with this? And my super Christian, ultra-Republican, like, straight-laced friend, former Fighting Illini guard John Burns, NCAA Division I football player and bartender that I worked with, looked at me and said, you're an effing dirtbag. And my friend Dave, the scuzziest guy that I knew, like, worked at a pizza place, and he and I drank about 150 beers a week together. He said, 17, that's not a bad thing. That's the best thing. But my mom had the best response. She goes, for heaven's sake, worry about dating a 17-year-old when you're 34. Which was fantastic. Which is one of the best things my mom's ever said.
I wonder if you were the 17-year-old, she might have had a different answer, though.
I don't think so. I think my mom was just pleased anytime I was able to have my act together enough to actually have a girlfriend, because that was a sign that I might not just like fall into the sewer and drown. I was
in her basement forever.
I was a special child when I was, in my late teens, early 20s. I was definitely, let's just say I was primed for the restaurant industry. but at my place of work, there was this girl that I liked, and she liked me, and she was aggressive. And I was like, okay, this is happening. And I also worked with her mom, and I also worked with her younger sister. So this girl's entire immediate family worked with us at this restaurant. Now, as a 21-year-old that was hooking up with a 17-year-old server where I worked, I had a vested interest in the immediate family not finding out what I was up to. And my coworker, Jimmy, decided that it would be super funny to start calling me Waitress Cobra. He'd be like, "What's up? What's up, Waitress Cobra?" Just to get mom.
Oh, that's freaking funny.
And so mom was like, "Jimmy, why do you keep calling him that?" He's like, "Oh, no reason, Paula. Like, this is a real thing. This is a real thing that a real coworker of mine did to me."
Oh, no reason at all, ma'am.
So yeah, that is the best and cruelest nickname I've ever been given. And then, like at my wedding, my best man, Ray, gave a speech wherein he just recounted that entire story to the entire family party. So that was where,
and that was the big deal to mom and sis.
Oh yeah, well, I mean,
they had to have known. You got married. I mean,
yeah, they figured out when she moved in. Like it was a thing. And but she was mom was definitely not into me, and sis was also somewhat recalcitrant. A lot of Jesse hating going on, but it was, yeah.
An ace. You're good.
I don't know why. I don't know what she was thinking, but I'm pretty solid in the way things worked out.
Jackpot. Yep.
Oh,
he's awesome.
My dad took her aside and was like, "You know, he's getting the better deal, right?" I'm like, "Ah, what the hell, Dad?"
was honest, though.
That's another true thing that happened. It kind of reminds me of the time my mom told me I wasn't the kind of guy girls wanted to bring home to their parents. I was like, thank you.
Daggers.
So there is a real life story about a real life workplace nickname that I really enjoyed. Nate, you ever gotten any good workplace nicknames? Or were you just Nate Dog after Regulators came out and that was it forever?
Yeah, that was the big one. Natron. That was a pretty good one. My buddy Phil was really good at dishing out the nicknames. He had a different one for me every day, but Nate Dog is the one that stuck the most. Well, for sure.
I remember where your wife had to get okay with people referring to her as Mrs. Dog on the reg. It's like to the point where she would call the kitchen and be like, "Hello, is Nate there?" Like, yeah.
No, she would say Nathan because my family calls me that.
Is Nathan there?
And they'd be like, "Who? Who's Nathan?"
She'd be like, "Is Nate Dog there?" And then she, yes. And then Tyler would be like, "Yes, who's calling?" And she's like, "Oh, it's Mrs. Dog."
He would make her say Mrs. Dog.
Every time. It was
I'm
great.
Sorry, I don't know. I don't know who Stephanie is. Who's calling, please?
I want to clarify for the listeners that everyone involved in this conversation was like 31. There were no teenagers involved here. These were a bunch of
And this was like pre-cell phone, like, well, not pre, but before everyone had one in their pocket.
So the kitchen phone was still a viable way of getting a hold of it.
Yes,
also,
it was a viable option.
In the beginning, when cell phones came out, cooks didn't have them out. They went in your bag. Nah. And you were not supposed to check.
I kind of thought they were dumb. Like, why the hell do I need email in my pocket? Hell with that.
Oh, I was a resistor. I got my first smartphone.
Yeah, I was not a big fan. And then I was like, okay, this is pretty sweet.
I got my first smartphone like 5 years ago. Like, I was the last one of the party.
I resisted for about a year and a half, 2 years.
I wonder if John Holmes has a cell phone now.
He does.
He does.
In fact, he has a cell phone. He got one last year.
J-Hole was the last holdout.
He was the last. He was like
the last man standing.
The road warrior.
And it was funny because if you asked him what his cell number was, he'd rattle off a number. And just like he had it memorized. But if you call it, it was Crime Stoppers.
It was always Crime Stoppers. I've called Crime Stoppers a couple times. I'm like, oh, wait, that's John.
God damn it, John. By the way, if anybody doesn't know John Holmes, I'm not sure where he's working now, but I know
he is the AM Sue at Edmonds.
Oh,
Heather,
is he still
Triple
there?
H. Yeah.
He is one of
he's a badass.
He is one of the most talented cooks in Charleston. Hat tip. I'm kind of disappointed you got a cell phone, but on the other hand, You're a warrior, John Holmes. You got more biceps in your ponytail than I have in my entire body.
Oh, yeah. That guy is a beast. The guy is so passionate. I love that guy. I want to cook with him again so bad.
Oh, he
hooked up. So passionate.
He hooked up some of the, like, I love Baco and I love Mikey. A couple of times Holmes threw down when I was there, and it was some of the best meals I've had in Charleston.
Yeah, I went into Baco. I mean, this is no indictment on Mikey, but when we went into Baco and Holmes was there that night, oh my God.
Well, and the thing is, it's comparing apples to oranges because
it's completely different styles. Like, Mikey's super traditional.
Well, also, Mikey had to run the place.
Oh, yeah.
Holmes could just go in there.
He could just cook. Yeah.
The difference between being the executive chef slash owner and being the executive sous chef.
You're spread a little thin.
Yeah, like Holmes's normal shift was 10 to 5, but we'd have people come in. He'd stay after 5 for 4 more hours. The mm-hmm. thing is, when you're an exec chef, you can't just manufacture 4 hours like that. Like, I really learned. When I became an exec, I was like, oh, this is a whole thing. Like,
this is hard.
It's not about cooking at that point. It's about managing. The fire marshal's here. I don't care how much prep you have to do. You got to go deal with this.
But of course, you still have to prep and cook and butcher and make sauces. And
somebody was like, is it true that before you become a chef, you have to peel onions for 10 years? And I was like, well, yeah, but after you become a chef, you still have to peel onions. Like, mm-hmm. that whole chef with a clipboard, that whole stereotype, that is dead. That is not real.
That ain't a thing no more.
In today's labor market, the only difference between the dishwasher and the chef is the chef also has to cook and write the menu.
Mm-hmm. And the schedule and all that. Yeah.
Oh, brutal.
Yep. God,
being a chef is hard, man.
It is hard. Speaking of being a chef, we wanted to talk a little bit about, not refine your thinking, but rephrase your questions.
Yeah.
There's a way you can connect with people in our industry if you're not in our industry by just a simple rephrasing or rewording of like some questions you ask, and chefs will take you way more seriously if you do this.
And the thing is, chefs love to talk about their field.
They love it.
As is
evidenced
by this.
There's nothing worse than a cookie cutter question, generic. It's like,
I think it's probably like being any other kind of artist. I mean,
yes.
Are you going to ask Jimi Hendrix who his favorite guitar player is? Like, he's going to have, if Jimi Hendrix were here right now, tip the 40, he would have to measure his answer because his favorite guitarist may well be someone that trained him coming up that you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. But instead, he's got to figure out, you know, he's got to name one of his contemporaries, one of the people that he was competing with. Like, better to refine
you need
your
to
question.
You need to have more measured answers with like the cookie cutters. So a lot of times chefs have their cookie cutter answers.
And the
it's
thing
just
is,
like, you know, you got to play it safe. You got to play it a little vanilla because you don't know who the person is. But if you ask a specific direct question, you're going to get a way better answer.
Also, there's times where chefs have to think about the politics of it. Who's going to hear about this?
Yes.
Like, if you asked me who is the chef in Charleston that's been the most successful at realizing his vision, I would give you an answer. And if you ask me which chef in Charleston is the most overrated dickhead, I might just give you the same answer. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, and I'm betting all the money in my checking account that Nate knows exactly who I'm referring to, but we're going to go ahead and leave that aside. So there are ways to get granular. There are ways to really pick a chef's brain if you want to do it. So, Nate, what are some examples of some questions that you get that you feel like could be worded differently to get more out of you?
Well, you know, and it's completely harmless. I'm not trying to shit on people for wanting to ask. Like, it's a genuine, they really want to know, but it's just maybe just be a little less generic with it. You know, instead of saying, oh, who's your favorite chef? That's kind of a beta loaded question. You know, there's a lot of politics involved, but maybe say, who's your favorite French chef? You know, like, who's your favorite 3-star chef? Or, you know, things like that. Just kind of reword the question just a little bit, just put a little more thought into it and you'll get a way better answer.
That's exactly it. And the thing is also, who's your favorite chef is such a broad question. Like, I like
in which country, in which state, like in this city, like, are you,
Even something as simple, even something as
you
simple,
have no idea how addicted I am to this.
Even something as simple as what's your favorite restaurant is still a complex question, because what's your favorite restaurant? There's definitely two answers for anyone in the world. There's two answers. Not anyone. I guess some people, you know, the Jeff Bezos set, they don't have to think like this. But for me, what's your favorite restaurant is a very different question based on if I'm paying or if you're paying. Like yeah. for the longest time, back when Two Burrows Larder was open, I would tell anybody Two Burrows Larder is my favorite restaurant if I'm paying.
That was my favorite restaurant, dude.
Like and all chefs'
I
favorite
to,
restaurant.
I need to tell Josh that again. I ran into Josh and he says, "What's up?" And I need to remind him how much I love that place.
Tell him I said the same thing, that like for the longest time.
He asked about you.
Well, that's
like,
good.
How's Jesse doing?
Again, I haven't talked in a while. Josh Keeler is one of the most talented chefs in Charleston. And the thing is, I realized that the pressures of owning are just a lot. And the thing is, if he, despite the fact that what he built wasn't really sustainable, what he built was amazing. Two Burrows Larder.
Well, back to Mikey too. It's like you're spreading so thin, man.
What Mikey has
built.
He's
a chef owner. Chef-owned restaurants are always the best ones.
Yeah.
But the chef is just spread paper thin.
The place that we're talking about, by the way, we keep on referring to Mikey. We're referring to Mikey Scaramelia. His last name is a mouthful.
Scaramelia, I think.
Scaramelia, Mikey Scaramelia. He's, you know what? I'll probably correct myself in the podcast companion blog post. He is the chef and owner of an Italian restaurant called Bacco in Mount Pleasant. And if you can, you need to go. And
it's
tell
delicious.
Him, tell him that Jesse and Nate sent you, and maybe he'll check out the podcast. Hi, Mikey. Just one of the most stand up. I mean, the thing is, Mikey and Josh are very different types of chef, but they're both guys that are just getting it done. But
they're just both so passionate.
And both of those places would be on my list of my favorite restaurants if I'm paying. But if someone else is paying, I'm going to say Michelin stars every time, because why wouldn't I?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the question of what's your favorite.
I want to go for the moonsault.
Exactly. I could do it. I could do an elbow drop all day long, but the elbow drop's not going to pop the crowd. Moonsault's going to pop the crowd.
I'll sling you off the ropes and give you a clothesline all day long. No problem.
But if someone
you
else is paying.
You want to go for a moonsault? Are you buying?
If someone else is paying, senton splash time.
I'm going through the top turnbuckle.
For anyone that isn't following along, you need to watch more wrestling. That is all. So yeah, I feel like that's a great question. If somebody says, who's your favorite chef? Like, my favorite chef, off the top of my head, Tarver King. Because, you know, he's a great guy. He's my friend. He's a routine guest on this podcast. And I think that, you know, but the thing is, who's my favorite chef that taught me personally a lot of stuff? Or who's my favorite chef that I don't know from Adam? Or someone in the middle.
I have chefs I've never met that have had a tremendous impact on my cooking and my life, the way I think, the way
Fernand Point.
Oh my God. Even beyond the grave. Yes. Yeah. I'm not even talking about the guys who have passed away. Like even like just
Massimo
mentors that I call them mentors I've never met.
Exactly. Massimo Butera.
Yeah. I've never met that guy, but huge. That guy is the best.
The Purcell brothers.
Mm-hmm. Alain Ducasse.
Ferran Adrià.
Yeah, so many. But you know,
because we have to mention him on literally every episode, let's just go ahead and note Thomas Keller.
He's the king, man. He's the king of American cuisine.
I mean, asking a chef who his favorite chef is like asking Lord Byron who his favorite writer is. That's not an answerable question.
Yeah. So maybe like instead of saying this is the best thing I've ever had in my life, ask how did you prepare that fish so well? Like how did you make that?
Yeah,
like
ask
that
us
will get you a better answer.
Ask us
specific. How did you
questions?
Cook those carrots?
Yeah, we want to tell you. Like
we had a great meal, but how did you cook those carrots? Like, yes, you're gonna get some. Yes, let's talk. That's good. What's your favorite kind of pasta? Well, that depends on the sauce. Like, how am I supposed to answer that?
Yeah. Like if you meet a chef and you get to talk to a chef, get granular and ask.
Chefs like to talk.
As is evidenced by this circle jerk of a podcast.
They like to talk about food. You want to talk about other stuff, they're going to get weird.
Well, depending on what the other stuff is, but like, don't ask a chef about politics.
Nah.
First off, we're usually not all that well read. Second off, we can't get into that because, you know, our workers believe one thing, and if our place is expensive enough, our clientele believes the exact opposite, and we gotta walk the line.
Yeah, you just like, gotta keep your mouth shut. It's kind of like going to a bar. No politics, no religion, and right. You're probably pretty good.
Right, but if you want to talk about sports or wrestling, hell yeah.
But anyways, yeah, just get a little, that's just a little pro tip for anyone who may not be a professional. Like, you know, they don't speak our language. Like one of my mentors, Scott Crawford, he's a great chef too. I learned a lot from him. But I always loved the way he put it. It's kind of like being in Fight Club. You're either in the club or you're not. You either get it or you don't. And if you're not in the Fight Club, a way to like relate to people in the club is get a little granular and, you know, just rephrase your questions a little bit, you know, it's not that we're offended. It's fine. We don't get mad about it. It's just, we'll take more interest in your question.
Yeah. And the thing is, you only get a limited number of conversations with people of any extreme profession, chef being one of them. You only get so many conversations with them, you know, per annum or in your lifetime. So make them count.
Yeah. Make them count. And it's like, we know it's innocent and it's not, you know, it's super, it's, you know, whatever. You know, but if you tell us that's the best meal you've ever had in your life, we'll probably think you're a schmuck, but we'll answer and smile and nod and know that there's probably 10 things we could have done better to make your meal better, but we'll say thank you and move on.
Absolutely. Well, so on that note, everyone listening should write us some questions to give us something to talk about, because we always favor user submissions. But when it's stuff we can actually make some hay with, it's always a little better.
Yeah, please be sure to hashtag Waitress Cobra.
Yes, thank you for that, Nate.
I love that. I forgot. You had told me that, but a long time ago. I forgot about that. Oh, man. Is D a mongoose or what?
I'm going to go ahead and not answer that on the grounds that she's in the room.
don't do that.
Well, I have a topic to pivot to.
Yes.
And this is, Nate, have you ever been just going through papers and or computer notes or something and found notes on a dish that you don't even really remember writing, but you're like, that's brilliant.
All the time.
This happened to me just now.
Really?
As I was going through my notes, taking notes for our podcast, like list of topics, I found a note that described the process for making a steak and blue cheese flavored Cheeto.
Ooh.
So
see, I find stuff like that all the time. Just a little note. Okay, so chefs and cooks, if you don't have one, I'm going to be pissed at you if you're a chef or a cook, but we have like so many notebooks filled with just brain farts and ideas or something we saw on a menu that thinks looks cool or recipes or ratios, like everything. And every once in a while we take a trip down memory lane and we thumb through our notes or a notepad and be like, oh yeah.
It's especially,
we don't remember. We've done so many dishes. I don't
total
remember.
Lack of memory lane where I'm like, what was I thinking there?
We do the work and then we go and we move on to the next thing.
So a Cheeto at its essence is a corn dough that's aerated. Like you put, imagine a whipped cream charger. If you put basically cornbread batter in a whipped cream charger and then extrude it directly into hot grease, it puffs up and gets crunchy. And that's the base of a Cheeto.
You ever heard of those puffing guns?
No.
Those cereal guns? You like put grains or whatever in a hopper and it's pressurized and then it heats and you literally shoot it out and it explodes when it puffs out. It's crazy.
That sounds like a ton of fun.
Check out Dave Arnold. He has one. There's one at the Museum of Food and Science, I think, in New York City where he's the director of.
I will definitely put a link to a video.
Those things are terrifying though. Like they've blown up on them before.
Oh man.
But they're really cool. That's how they used to do it before modern. Sorry, I jumped all over you there.
That was great. I didn't know about that. But so the Cheeto at its most basic is corn batter that's extruded under pressure, inflated with gas into hot grease, which sets it. That's how they get that sort of puffy texture. And then the cheese flavor is all in the powder. And the powder is just, I'm pretty sure it's just cheap cheese, annatto seed, orange dye, and tapioca maltodextrin. So tapioca maltodextrin is a food starch product that when you mix it with a fat, turns it into powder. It's how restaurants are able to do like brown butter powder or olive oil powder or foie gras powder, peanut butter powder, any number of powders. And the thing is, there's not a lot of places where it has a ton of utility, but it really is pretty great at making cheese powder. And I'm not certain, but I'm reasonably certain that that's how Cheetos get their cheese. At least, even if it's not, you know, how it works at the Cheetos factory, it's how I would do it in my home kitchen. So the notes that I have involve making corn batter and putting it into an extruder and then shooting it into a pot of rendered beef fat. So you're frying corn batter and beef fat and then taking a powder that's made partly of just sort of crystallized beef base and partly of blue cheese powder that's made by taking, you know, Sysco blue crumbles and maltodextrin and putting them in the food processor together to make a steak and blue cheese flavored Cheeto. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what the context is. I have no recollection of this. I just looked at it and was like, well, that's clever. It's in my handwriting.
I love stuff like that. I find stuff like that all the time, like, oh yeah, that was a good idea, or I don't remember where I picked that one up, but that's brilliant.
I'm adding that to my, I have a fantasy menu that I'm working on, and I call it the Sin City menu. The reason I call it the Sin City menu is based on the comic book Sin City, which a lot of you have probably seen the movie. The comic book Sin City was this depraved, noir, you know, ninja hookers fighting gangster murderers, ridiculous, over-the-top comic book.
Yeah.
But
I remember when we went to Mario's and I said I hadn't seen Sin City and you got super pissed at me.
Yeah, I did. I do remember that.
I gotta watch that yet. I haven't seen
You'll it. Like it. It's violent and stupid and just dark. It's right up your alley. It's a little weird, but you'll like it. I keep my Sin City menu in the back of my head. My Sin City menu is Sin City was drawn and written by Frank Miller, who was a guy that worked for both Marvel and DC and did Comics Code approved kids comics for like 25 years. And I don't know this to be true, but my impression was that Sin City was the place where he just dumped all of his ideas that he couldn't use in kids comics. You know, 2 decades worth of, oh, it'd be cool if this happened. Oh, that would never, never make it. It'd be cool if that happened. That'd never make it. So I've got a running menu in my head of just ideas that I've come up with that are the wrong style for the place where I work. And it's just a huge list. It's like, maybe it's too shishi for the bar that I'm working at, or maybe it requires fine dining execution, but it doesn't exactly have fine dining elegance. And some people can get away with that. Like Wiley Dufresne, I think, is a good example of someone who's been able to like do stuff that's not fine dining level in terms of flavor profile, but is totally fine dining level in terms of execution.
Yes, and that was a great example.
He's been able to do that, but not everybody gets to do that. Normally, if it's a Thomas Keller or even a Grant Achatz, then they got to think, they got to think, how does this play? Is this 4-star? Is this 3-star? Is this 5-star? You know.
And it's not that a lot of chefs can't do it and like have the talent to do it. It's the stars have all got to align. And that's no knock on Wiley. He's an OG.
No, not at all.
But there's a little bit of luck in there too, to get it right click. And you got to be in a really big city usually.
Yeah. Because the thing is, you got to have lightning in a bottle, because Alain Ducasse would never do a dish based on, for instance, pizza. It would just be weird. Meanwhile, Dave Chang, I don't think necessarily can punch at the 3-star level. To be able to do both of those things at once is rare. And so that's kind of the point of my Sin City menu, is dishes that are homeless. Like a good example is I had kalbi for the first time. Have you ever had kalbi, Korean short ribs?
Yes.
Like they slice them thin and they marinate them for like an hour or two and then just grill them quick. But they're sliced so thin that they're quick grilled short ribs. I was tasting it and I was like,
they're not all chewy and gummy.
Because you've cut them across the grain. They bone saw them. They bandsaw them. So the bones are these little nibs.
Yep.
And then the reason short ribs get tough is because they have a very long, firm grain. And the Western response to cooking short ribs is hammer them for hours and hours and hours.
Low and low, lots of moisture.
And then, but the Korean example is like, no, don't worry about that. Just cut them across the fibers into eighth of an inch thick slices, throw them in a marinade to tenderize them a little bit, and then just grill them up quick and just eat them out
high
of
high radiant heat.
Eat them out of a paper bucket. And it's funny because like I thought that blew my mind. I was like, short ribs, quick cook short ribs. So everyone's always talking about 23-hour short ribs or, you know, 13-hour short ribs. I wanted to do 2-minute short ribs. But the thing is, my thought was, let's do them in a completely Western style. Let's take the Korean out of the equation. Let's use the Korean technique in a Western motif. So I thought, okay, how would we do that? Well,
so make like a pot of pho, like sauce and dish, or like ragu
My thought was to make a house-made Worcestershire sauce. Tamarind, garlic, anchovy, cook it down and use that for
I've
the marinade.
I've made Worcestershire before. It's good.
Use that
it's
for
a pain
the marinade.
In the ass, though.
Yes. I remember I was working the kettle room at Commander's Palace when the Worcestershire was cooking out, and I wanted to die. Can you imagine breathing the fumes of 25 gallons of Worcestershire sauce for like
Tamarind is so tannic and acrid.
Just an 8-hour shift of just inhaling Worcestershire sauce fumes. You know, do the marinade in that and grill them up quick, and then top the whole thing with grated horseradish and serve it alongside some Yorkshire pudding.
Nice.
And I thought
I love Yorkshire pudding. Oh my God, I haven't made those in so long.
And I like
they
little ones.
They make such a mess, but they are so good.
I thought that would be a great little but the thing is that dish is a dish without a home because it's too much you're not going to get people that are willing to pick up short ribs and gnaw them off the bone in a fine dining setting. So that unfortunately is where my blue cheese and steak Cheeto lives on the Sin City menu.
I love this idea. I love this concept. Like, send us your Sin City menus and we'll talk about them.
By all means.
I could write one right now. I could write an 8-course Sin City menu that would be amazing and completely impractical.
Yeah, exactly. another one of the dishes from my Sin City menu is pretzel gnocchi with guanciale and mustard butter. And the reason
I remember that one, we used to do the pretzel gnocchi on the restaurant week menu because some dumbass thought it would be cool. And everyone hated me by the end of the month.
I was going to say, that was you, wasn't it?
That was me, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wait, did you invent pretzel gnocchi?
I don't think I invented it. Hell no, but we did it.
I thought I did. I don't remember that one. Maybe that was that might have been
one of those. I don't think you were working with us then.
Oh, was it Tristan?
But we did it on the restaurant week menu.
Man, I stole your idea and I didn't even give you credit for it. Guys, I was fully of the opinion.
I'm sure someone's done it before.
For me, the pretzel gnocchi thing came in because I was working at Social and somebody was rolling a pretzel out of pizza dough and then baking it. And I was like, that's not how you make a pretzel. And I showed them the trick, which is where you blanch the pretzel in baking soda stock you're supposed to use lye, but if you don't have lye on hand, which it's reasonable to assume that you might not have lye in your
house. Don't have lye on hand. Don't let anyone fuck around with that shit.
It's bad for you.
It's safe, but you gotta be careful.
Right. It's like kerosene that way. Baking soda is a lot more unlikely to yield a horrible disfiguring chemical burn. But you make alkali water.
Yep.
You blanch the pretzel in the alkali water. And then you bake it.
Yep. And alkalinity, so things that are alkaline lower the temperature at which the Maillard reaction happens, and which is the browning reaction, which should be called the flavor reaction. We'll talk about the Maillard reaction another time, but
that's a whole
trick
thing.
Bagels too, pretzels.
Yeah. Any bread that you get that has that shiny, polished brown exterior, but a relatively soft inside.
That's alkaline.
Because if you baked a pretzel until it got that dark on the outside, it would be dry and crunchy through and through.
Ruined.
It would be totally hammered. But the way they make soft pretzels and bagels is you use the alkaline to get to lower the browning, the lower the temperature at which the browning effectively occurs. That's how you get that great crust.
Good cook on it.
I showed the cook how to do that. And this is one of the younger guys who, like, you know how sometimes when you show somebody that's 21 how to do something, their mind just gets blown.
Uh-huh.
And they're like,
yeah.
Oh, and you're like, ha, 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 your brain got a new wrinkle. But then as a result, we were dicking around with pretzels for hours. And somebody was like, we could make pretzel gnocchi. And I was just like, could? No, not could. Can and will. And
yeah, that's exactly what I just, instead of par blanching the gnocchi, I dipped it in the alkaline and then baked them off. And then on the pickup, had them all cooled and ready. And then on the pickup, hit them in the pan.
How many great dishes have been come up with by bored chefs dicking around on a slow day?
Probably more than you'd ever want to know. And then, you know, like, you know what else is funny too? It's like, you come up with a dish and you work on it for weeks and it's just error, getting it just right. And then sometimes you just come up with pretzel gnocchi and it works in an hour and it's everyone's favorite goddamn dish. And it's like, that's the one everybody loves. That's the one. It took me 5 minutes. I love it, but damn it.
It is kind of disheartening when the one that really, really knocks their socks off is the one that you spent 20 minutes on.
You needed something fast and you pulled one right out of your keister and you just threw it together and it's a smash hit. It's like, oh, that's the one. Fine.
I have a good example of that happening. It was at Social and I had been told to do a brunch menu and I had to pull a brunch menu just out of my ass. I had 2 weeks to come up with it. And the thing is, it was hard. I mean, because the thing is, that was my first ever, real executive chef job where I had complete creative control. No disrespect to Burwell's, but I never really had complete creative control there. And so I really wanted to show out. So we had, that was a great menu. We had like biscuits and gravy with confit pork cheeks. And that dish was evil. We had a country pate Monte Cristo. I straight up stole Vedrinsky's cornflakes crusted French toast. But
yeah, and that's fine. You can find inspiration anywhere and whatever, man. It happens all the time. But always give credit where credit is due. Always. Someone has the rare original idea, give them goddamn credit for it. Yeah, so, that's not cool, man. If you get inspiration from someone, just say it. It's okay.
Yeah, like a great example of a dish that I stole outright.
Inspired by, adapted from,
the dish
you're
that
good.
The dish that I stole outright and then told everyone about was the anchovies with bread and butter, which Nate and I had at Two Amy's Pizza and were blown away by. I started offering it at Social, and anytime anybody asked me how I got the idea, I was like, oh, Two Amy's Pizza in D.C., they did that. I just brought it here, like 100%, no credit taken whatsoever. I was like, I'm a guy that just opened a can of anchovies and toasted a baguette and whipped some butter. That's it. You know, it's all about giving credit where credit's due. But it's funny, I made a mistake. And there was one dish that I just plain forgot to think about. And that was the shrimp and grits. I was compelled to have shrimp and grits. I was told that I had to have shrimp and grits. And I had a concept. I had a concept for the shrimp and grits. My concept was going to be shrimp and polenta. And then the shrimp and polenta was going to be using all as many name-controlled products as possible. So I would have authentic Spanish chorizo and authentic Spanish piquillo peppers and do a Spanish-style shrimp and grits. And they had picked out a light Rioja to go with it. So the day comes. It's the day of the first brunch, and I'm putting up one of every dish. And I start to put up the shrimp and grits, and I'm like, never actually made the sauce for the shrimp and grits. So I was like it was in real time. I'd already started putting dishes out. It was just a tough day and I screwed up. So the sauce, I was like, all right, what do I got? On my pizza station, I had tomato sauce for the regular tomato sauce pizzas, but I also had Coco Van gravy for the Coco Van pizzas. I had a Coco Van pizza that was like, you make Coco Van, so chicken and wine. So mirepoix, chicken cooked down until the chicken falls apart. And then I pureed the mirepoix into the sauce. So it would be like a nice, you know, have some body to it. And then I topped that pizza with Gruyere, mozzarella, chicken, mushrooms, bacon, onions. So it was like all the flavors of a classic Coco Van on a pizza. And it was a hit. It was the Stephanie Barna of the City Paper made a special category in their best of best new pizza. Just so they could give it an award, which I always appreciated. I was like,
that
it would
was
have
been great pizza.
It would have been nice to win an award that someone had voted for, but it was also cool that a local food writer was like, nah, let's go ahead and just create a category for him to win it.
That was a great pizza.
It was great. One of my few unique creations. I'm kind of creativity averse most times, but this day I was creative. I was like, all right, damn it. I don't have a sauce for the shrimp and grits. So I had the grits ready and I sauteed the shrimp and then just built a sauce in a pan using stuff that I had in front of me. So I put a knob of butter in, sauteed the shrimp, added a ladle of the Coco Van sauce and a ladle of the tomato sauce, swirled all that together with a handful of minced chorizo and a handful of julienne piquillo peppers, and just brought that together with another little knob of butter, a squeeze of lemon and some seasoning. And that was it. And it was a total ass pull based on total prep failure. And it was the hit of the day.
Total Brad, ass pull.
Brad, the owner, comes back. He's like, chef, that shrimp and grits was the best I've had in town. What'd you put in the sauce? And I was like, dude, it was so hack, I don't even want to tell you what it is.
It's an old dog family recipe.
No, I didn't lie. I was just like, man, this is so hack, I don't even want to tell you what's in it. And he just looked at me kind of sideways and goes, it was just Coco Van sauce and tomato sauce, wasn't it? And I was like, yeah, pretty much. So yeah, I do empathize when the thing that's the big hit is the thing that you just hip shot. Because I absolutely hip shot that shrimp and grits, and it came out great.
It happens, man, and it's like, son of a.
Like, oh,
that's the thing now. You can't, and then you're the asshole who didn't have their favorite dish the last time they were there if you take it off the menu.
Oh my God. Yeah. Some people will, sometimes
they'll come back for that dish and you're like, oh.
You know, that's an interesting topic. Let's get into that. When is it okay to take off a fan favorite dish?
That is a slippery slope.
It's a touchy business. I mean, I worked at a restaurant.
Cooks want to take it off immediately.
Yeah. They're like, I don't like this. It's
I'm
stupid.
Done with this dish.
Social's another good example. When I took it over, the happy hour food was set in stone. It was not to be changed. And the happy hour dishes, there were five. It was margarita pizza, which I had no problem with. I mean, we were a wood-fired pizza place, so giving away a $3 or $4 margarita pizza during happy hours, like a little individual. And then it was Roman style, so it wasn't much food. That was great. Then we had sliced potato chips with like house fried potato chips with blue cheese fondue. Once again, no problem there. It's good bar food. It's good beer food. Good happy hour food.
But then salty, they had fatty, crunchy. Perfect.
Then they had three dishes that were extremely Asian. There were spring rolls with shrimp that were dipped in a soy and ginger. They called it aioli, but there wasn't garlic in it, so that enraged me. But a soy sesame ginger mayonnaise. We in the back referred to it as Wu-Tang. So, let me get a side of Wu-Tang. So spring rolls dipped in Wu-Tang, which is probably pretty cultural appropriation-y, but it was in place when I got there. And then we had jasmine rice balls that were just like Thai sticky rice with a lot of coconut, fried. They were like Thai arancini, but they were really, really sweet. And we dipped those in a red curry sauce. And then there were chicken satays that were rolled in the same red curry sauce and then served over a puck of the same sticky rice. And I was frustrated because those dishes weren't really European. Like, it's a wine bar. Why do we have three Asian dishes? And I was able to sub them out little by little as we went. The spring rolls were the biggest holdout. Everyone's like, oh, people will freak out if you don't have the spring rolls. And it really just came down to, I've got to find something that's concept appropriate that can beat the spring rolls. And everyone said, you know, that people are going to lose their minds. People are going to lose their minds. I was like, okay, so the way I've got to do this is by getting the servers behind the thing that I put on to replace it. And what we did was a croque monsieur using confit pork. So we'd cook a whole pork belly in fat, like salt cure it and then confit it and then shred it. And then mix the shredded confit pork belly with grated Gruyere and scallions and whole grain mustard, and then make grilled cheeses with that as the filling on sliced baguette. Beautiful. And so it was a little more prep heavy, but only once the confit was made, it was super prep easy. So the confit was kind of a pain in the dick, but after that, it was super simple. And the science was getting the servers to understand, like, yes, they liked that. They're also going to like this. It's a ham and cheese sandwich, essentially. So they're going to connect on a cellular level. But on the other hand, it's more concept appropriate. And that's a narrative you can sell. If you explain your logic and you get the servers to buy in, that can be the ball game. If you have to take away a dish people really like and the servers believe, because nothing will undermine you faster than a bunch of servers who are, you know, acting like, oh, I don't know why the chef took it off. No one's going to go for this. And then they start rolling their eyes.
If your sales force isn't behind it, you're done.
And if they start rolling their eyes tableside, then the server is going to be like, yeah, this arrogant chef, and they're not going to come back. That's why, like,
Remember the she crab raviolo?
Oh yeah, that was a great example. Tell that story. It's a great example of the same thing.
So we had she crab on the menu at Tristan, and it was the previous chef, and they had it on. It was a menu staple, but it was a perfect she crab. It was a perfectly good she crab.
It was actually a really good, maybe one of the best I've had.
It was really good. But we didn't want to serve she crab. We were trying to go a little more modern, forward thinking.
For those of you who are not familiar, she crab is the she crab soup is one of the official dishes of the Lowcountry where we live and work. Invented in Charleston, South Carolina. It is essentially a bowl of bechamel with crab roe, sherry, and crab base added. I'd like to sugarcoat it all I can, but that's it. It's a bowl of milk gravy with fishy things in it. It is a perfectly serviceable dish.
With a little onion.
a little onion, a little celery. It's a kind of a dull dish. It's famous. It's one of the things that we're famous for. It shouldn't really be something we're famous for because it's not that good compared to things like Hop and John that are also local that are super awesome. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she crab soup is just one of those things that we have to deal with. But the thing is, it's the kind of thing you get when you go to a cafe or a diner, you know, or like an old school restaurant like Pugin's Porch. Or if you're like, you know, you go get a ham sandwich at Lost Dog Cafe before you go to the beach. That's where you get a bowl of she crab.
And it sells year round. It is a piping hot cream-based soup, and people buy it all year long. In the middle of August, they want a bowl of it. It blows my mind.
The thing is, neither one of us particularly like it, but we both respect that it has its place.
Yes, but it's good.
At Tristan, we were trying to be modern, and there's nothing modern about she crab soup. So Nate's going to tell you about the inventive way that he got around this problem.
Yeah, so we concocted a way to wean the management and service staff off of she crab.
It was really the management that needed to come around on that one.
They did not want us to budge on it. Like, you gotta have she crab, gotta have she crab, gotta. And I respected where they came from, but you know, we didn't want to make she crab all the time.
Specifically, the manager in question that we were at odds with is the best guy.
But
we were on the opposite sides on this one. On this issue, that we were on the opposite sides of the coin.
The best. I love that guy.
So but there's anyways, no evil here at all.
So we developed a dish using a couple modernist techniques and hydrocolloids to make like a liquid ravioli. So when you cut open the ravioli, the she crab would pour out. We put a little crab in the cup. We'd cup the ravioli and it looked like a flower, and we filled it with all the little garnishes that went into the soup, spritzed it with a little sherry wine right before it went out, and we frothed up some like vegetal bubbles and put it all around. It looked like it was in the ocean, and when you cut open, like the soup would pour out. And we made him one. He loved it, and he was like, okay, let's try it. And it was a great dish, and we couldn't make those damn things fast enough.
Yeah, the one thing is, anytime one of the words that you can always put on a menu to make something sell is ravioli. Americans flip or
lobster
out. Yeah, lobster is another one, but Americans flip
lobster
out.
Raviolis, you're gonna be
forget about it. That's all you're doing for the rest of time. I mean, the word ravioli just makes Americans want to order it. It doesn't matter what's in the ravioli. Yep. It will sell and sell and sell, which is problematic because ravioli is super labor intensive.
Yeah, they take a lot of work. But it was a great dish. People loved it. People kind of became known for it a little bit around town. I mean, for the short time we did it, whatever. But
that was a good point of strategy.
It was a cool dish. It was a good chef strategy. It was a good marketing strategy. It was a good getting the sales force behind it strategy.
And I remember you were like, we can't have she crab and a she crab ravioli as two different apps on a menu that only has 8 apps. We had you don't want to repeat flavors or ingredients or profiles. So really, by the way to get around having the she crab that we didn't want to have on the menu was to make the she crab superfluous. And it was well done. It was well spotted.
Yeah, that worked out really well. And that was a good compromise.
And the thing is, here's a cautionary tale. And then I think we should probably close this episode down for time.
Yeah.
I have a cautionary tale. I worked at a restaurant when I was in my early 20s. Like, maybe, like, I turned 21 when I worked at this restaurant. So all the way early 20s. It was called Gouliard's, and it was in Urbana, Illinois. The owner was a nice guy. He and his wife owned it. They were good people. His sous chef was this really cool, sarcastic asshole named Quan, who told me to go to Kendall, which is where I went to school. Like, he was a very big influence on me. Just very much. I mean, he was, like, visibly Chinese, but he was just Chicago as hell. He was, like, South Side attitude all day long.
Did he cook with a baseball jersey on?
No, he wore a chef jacket, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache, which was super fun. But then when he opened his mouth, when he opened his mouth, he spoke English with a strong Chicago Southside accent, and he just didn't have time for your crap. One of the coolest chefs, one of my really early influences. This place was great, but they shot themselves in the foot. In order to drum up business, they had $2 burger day. Tuesdays and Thursdays, they would have a half pound burger for $2. And then they also, they did their own, like, house fried fries. So we were blanching fries.
Oh, man.
Incredible volume. And Tuesday and
masochists.
Tuesday and Thursday, we would have a line out the door. And it was an incredibly good burger. They got their beef from, University of Illinois has an agriculture department. And they have an animal science, like, butchery, like, you know, basically their own slaughterhouse. And you could get meat from the university. And their stuff was top quality, and it was a pretty good price. They would price it really well. They made really good pork sausage. It was pretty cool. I mean, like, the University of Illinois is one of the colleges you send someone to if you want them to, you know, like, kind of like University of Nebraska, I'm sure, has a similar program, or Iowa, where it's like there's farms everywhere.
University of Georgia has a really good one.
This is how we learn how to process barn animals into meat products. We got their beef. It was top-notch beef, and we were selling it for bottom dollar. It was on a good bun, and I'm serious when I say half-pound burgers. For $2. And yes, it got buzz, but the place was only busy on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And even then they were losing money on those days. So eventually they just decided to put a stop to it, and they pushed really hard in the other direction. And rather than gradually, and I think they got themselves caught between a rock and a hard place, because rather than gradually inching their prices up, they just dropped the burger all at once and flipped their menu around big time. They had gotten a pretty good review out of the newspaper, and I think they thought that would carry them. And they dropped the burger entirely, and they put in what they called a stuffed burger instead, which was like black olives and feta cheese inside a burger patty, almost like a Juicy Lucy, but not quite as American. And it was like you could hear the record scratch. It stopped so fast. And after that, it was just two and a half weeks of just no customers, not enough to keep the place going. And then I showed up for my shift, and the door was locked. Like, if you're gonna put something on that's gonna be a huge draw, you have to be real careful as far as how
you hit the reset button hard. You do a hard reset, like when chefs do that when they take over a kitchen. Like, that's a huge gamble. You got to wean in. You got to cook the other guy's food for a while. Gradual change. Like when you just stop on a dime, that's a big gamble.
I think it makes sense in the world of ultra fine dining if the chef is kind of a name.
Yeah, if you relaunch and shut down and rebrand, yes.
Yeah, like if a place that was super famous, I don't know, if someplace like the restaurant at the Ritz-Carlton.
11 Madison.
11 Madison.
11 Madison, how they shut down over COVID and now they're coming back all vegan. Like,
which is...
That's a bold move, man.
That's a whole topic right there. Yeah, like but the thing is, you got to be a name to pull that off. And if you're not a name, then you got to do it gradually. And the most frustrating thing when you're a chef is when you take over a place and they do a press release, but you haven't had a chance to change any of the food yet. and then you go out in the dining room to say hi to someone, and they're like, "Oh, tell us about this," and you're like, "I don't even know how to make that. We're just running the prep out."
Yep.
I mean, when I took over social, there was this green curry chicken dish, and at one point I was like, "Hey Greg, how do we make more marinade for this green curry chicken?" And he goes, "I don't know." And I was like, "Well, who knows?" And he's like, "Literally no one. No one knows how to make that." And I was like, "Okay, well," it was probably my second week, and we just had a bunch of the chicken and marinade. And I was like, All right, let's put a fork out on chicken, and I have 12 hours to figure out a new chicken dish.
Yep, that's how it goes sometimes.
That's how it goes. And
that's always the best approach, is to gradually do it. Like, any chef who's listening and you're about to take over a restaurant, don't go in and just gather everything up in a box and then dump it on the table, and just don't do that. Gradual, little wins is what you want.
Like, yeah, the clientele, you might've been brought in because there's not enough clientele, but the clientele that you have is what's keeping the air conditioner running.
Yep. Start with the shittiest, most disastrous dish on the menu and make it a good one, and then just go from there.
I mean, my first, when I took over social, I looked at the general manager and he's like, so what do you want to do? I was like, you tell me what you think is best. Do you want to see a complete menu change, and I'll run this food for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then do a whole reprint? Or do you want instant impact? And he goes, oh, instant impact. I was like, okay, cool. And I 86 two dishes that night. And then at that point, it was like a constant running struggle. And it took about 4 months to get everything from the menu changed over to stuff that was appropriate for the concept. But, stuff that
don't
wasn't.
Don't try to fix what isn't broken right away.
Yeah.
Start on the problems and make them non-problems.
Yeah, look around the kitchen and figure out what your moneymakers are. And then start with the periphery. Start with the things that don't sell that much, because the things that do sell that much,
peripherals.
Things that do sell that much for a reason. This is seriously important chefing advice.
Then you're the jerk who doesn't have the best dish on the menu anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But
it's not very good.
Like, your job, you've been brought in as the chef of a restaurant. Your job isn't to make the best food. Your job is to expand the clientele.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the ball game.
That's the ball game. And I think that should be the ball game, huh? What do you think?
Yeah, I think let's go ahead and shut it down, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. This has been another episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. My partner is Nate Spinkick Whiting. I am the waitress Cobra, Jesse Sutton.
Thank you. I was going to jump all over you if you didn't say that.
No, I saw it in your eyes. Speakeasy's going to go ahead and play us out of here. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been great.
Keep your head up, come on, little baby. Keep your head up, come on, little baby. Keep your head up, come on, come on, come on, little baby. My little darling, my little sister. Come on, baby, just keep your head up. Come on, baby, just keep your head up.